It's Tuesday, January 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a nuclear test heats tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Tensions and discord in the Middle East affect global oil markets. Is China's economy faltering or just evolving? Also ahead,
you really challenged assumptions that we might have about gender, about sexuality, and so on.
One of the most influential musicians of our time dies. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Tensions remain high on the Korean Peninsula in the wake of North Korea's fourth atomic test last week. The commander of U.S. forces in South Korea has placed 28,000 U.S. military personnel on the highest state of alert. On Sunday, a U.S. B-52 bomber flanked by South Korean and U.S. fighters flew over South Korean territory. Troy Stangarone of the Washington-based Korea Economic Institute told VOA's Victor Beatty that the U.S. response has been appropriate.
What we've done is we've essentially taken and demonstrated to North Korea that we do remain committed to the defense of both South Korea and Japan, and that we have the means with which to take and defend them should North Korea decide to utilize its growing nuclear program for an attempt to take and either cause provocations on the peninsula or some other type of disruption to either South Korea or Japan.
The United States is also considering sending a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier to waters off the Korean Peninsula next month. Is that ratcheting up the pressure?
I think from what we've seen, North Korea is determined to take and continue to pursue its nuclear program. They are pursuing their missile programs as well, developing new types of delivery systems. And I think sending in an aircraft carrier demonstrates that we have not just the means through the air, but through the sea, and other ways to take and defend our allies in the region.
Kim Jong-un, in his first public comments about the test, called the explosion a self-defensive measure meant to protect the region from, quote, the danger of nuclear war caused by U.S.-led imperialists. This is pretty much the same type of rhetoric we've come to expect from North Korea.
Yes, and it tends to be something that demonstrates perhaps what they need internally for domestic consumption, but doesn't reflect necessarily the situation on the ground. We all know that the greatest danger of a nuclear conflict taking place is from North Korea's own nuclear program. If you look at the United States, South Korea, and Japan, they've all taken and sought to engage the North in some way over the past years. But despite efforts to take and reach out to discuss the nuclear program, South Korea's efforts through its Trust Politique program to build greater economic and cultural ties, Japan's efforts to the Abe administration over the last couple of years to try and resolve the abductee issue with North Korea. In all these situations, North Korea has both turned its back on these efforts and continued to take and push this program forward. So I think the real threat, as we all understand, is North Korea's own nuclear program and not the United States or South Korea.
Well, Troy, White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough on Sunday talk shows said the B-52 flight over South Korea was intended to underscore to South Korean allies the deep and enduring alliance that we have with them. He also said the U.S. is going to work with South Korea, Japan, China, and Russia to, quote, deeply isolate the North Koreans and squeeze them until they live up to prior commitments to get rid of their nuclear weapons.
I think this is going to be the tricky situation. As we look at economic sanctions going forward, you're going to try and find a common ground with the United States, Russia, South Korea, Japan, and the other members of the Security Council. Now, that's likely going to be a difficult situation. I can't imagine that China or Russia will want to put as much pressure on North Korea as the United States or the other U.S. allies might want to. But it also raises the question of what we're seeing now, either in Congress with the sanctions bill coming up next week or other measures that you could put in place, such as trying to take and remove North Korea's access to the SWIFT banking system, declaring them a counterfeiter, in which case then it would take and limit also further access to U.S. dollars and the U.S. banking system.
But Troy Stangarone says the resumption of South Korean propaganda loudspeaker broadcast, which Pyongyang has in the past considered an act of war, could be potentially destabilizing. It's time for us now to check out trending stories online. International Edition's social media correspondent G. Abby Lee is here to do just that. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
So, another name has been thrown into the U.S. presidential race.
That's right, as if it's not crowded enough already. CNN reported Monday that former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg is interested in running for the Oval Office. The report says he commissioned a poll to see how well he would do as a third-party candidate against Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. The CNN Politics Facebook shared the article.
Well, that's interesting. So what's the poll finding?
Well, the source who spoke with CNN apparently didn't say, but guess who had a lot to say on Facebook? The readers. The first person to comment wrote this: Bloomberg is as much of a liar as Clinton. He knew he couldn't win as a mayor in NYC as a Democrat after 9/11 and the strong leadership of Giuliani, then quickly changed parties once elected. His words cannot be trusted. Now, the words cannot be trusted were all in caps, by the way, so that means that person was really shouting it out. The second comment was also negative towards Bloomberg. It reads like this: ridiculous. He wouldn't have a chance. All anyone outside of New York knows about him is that he likes to control people's lives by telling them what they should drink and eat and how much of it they should have. He's a control freak.
Ah, that must be referring to the infamous soda ban, right?
That's right. Let me explain for our international listeners. While in office, Bloomberg introduced the sugary drinks portion cap rule, also known as the soda ban. The regulation put a limit on the size of soft drinks in New York City in an effort to combat overconsumption of sugary drinks. And I also want to add that in addition to serving as New York City mayor for three consecutive terms, he also built a financial data and media empire, Bloomberg LB. As for other comments, Jim, some Bernie Sanders supporters disputed that Clinton is a front runner in the Democratic Party and called CNN the Clinton News Network.
Well, did Bloomberg tweet about the CNN article?
No, his two tweets Monday are about British rock icon David Bowie and climate change. Jim?
Well, we'll certainly have a little bit more about David Bowie later in our program. Gee, we thank you always for bringing us What's Buzzing Online, and you can follow her on Twitter at G Abby Lee and also on our program's account at VOA underscore IE. I'm out there as well at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondence, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. The war of words continues between Saudi Arabia and Iran after the Saudi execution of a prominent Shiite cleric. That led to an attack on the Saudi embassy in Tehran by angry crowds. And then Saudi Arabia announced last week that it was cutting diplomatic relations with Iran. And the foreign ministers of both nations have since made strong comments. This has had an effect on global oil markets, and so we turn to Maria Gallucci, energy and environment reporter for International Business Times, who joins us to sort out through the complexities of the relationship.
In recent weeks, tensions have been flaring up between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Saudi Arabia last week severed ties with Iran, and recently on Sunday, the Saudi foreign minister accused Iran of interfering in Arab affairs and stirring up sectarian strife in the region. Iran, by contrast, has accused Saudi Arabia of bombing its embassy in Yemen and sort of using the spat between the two countries to sideline peace talks in Syria. So what you see is sort of a flaring up of tensions. It's a lot of talks back and forth. Everybody is watching two of the world's most important oil producers, and they both also have a lot of political influence on the region and the world.
What are some of the concerns about the oil output from these two countries amid the tensions? How would the tensions actually disrupt, perhaps, their output?
Initially, when the diplomatic relations were severed, oil prices went up a little bit because there was this concern that there would be an armed conflict that could for example, in a worst-case scenario, prevent oil exports from moving through the Strait of Hormuz, which is what connects the Persian Gulf to the open ocean. But, you know, over the last couple of days, those sort of initial fears have weakened, actually, and oil prices are continuing to drop. And that's really because the oil supply today is so strong and demand is pretty weak, or demand growth is pretty weak. And so really what you're seeing is there's not as much fear anymore as there initially was. Now, that said, if there was a huge armed conflict and there was a blockade in the Strait of Hormuz, that could really strain global oil supplies and potentially plunge countries into a recession. But that scenario is considered very extreme and, as of now, pretty unlikely.
The United States has become a top oil producer now and is exporting oil for the first time. Would that have an effect on perhaps dampening upward pressures on oil prices at this point?
Oh, absolutely. And it's part of the reason why, you know, in years past, if this tension broke out between Saudi Arabia and Iran, we probably would have seen a much more significant spike in oil prices. The fact that the U.S. is producing twice as much as it was in 2008, on top of the fact that Saudi Arabia and other OPEC nations are continuing to produce more oil, is a big reason why prices are actually dropping and not spiking. The U.S. has had a pretty large effect on the global oil markets and continues to be a reason why we see prices at, I think, they dropped below $32 a barrel today, which is the lowest level in 12 years.
The low prices would certainly affect the economies of both Iran and Saudi Arabia. And even if they didn't do anything, just the threat of a conflict would raise prices. That would almost benefit them in a sense.
Right, you would think so. But actually, for Saudi Arabia, they built up this massive stockpile of foreign reserves. I think it's around $600, $700 billion. And so that's sort of why Saudi Arabia can hold out a little bit longer with low prices or higher prices, whereas Iran is severely affected by these plummeting prices, combined with the fact that it's not exporting as much as it used to because of sanctions. So that definitely plays into the dynamic as well. Some analysts I spoke with said Iran might be less inclined to kind of stir up the pot even more than it already has because it so desperately needs to get rid of these sanctions and export more oil.
No doubt it's going to be a story for a long time. And we thank Maria Gallucci, energy and environment reporter for International Business Times, to bring us up to date on this. Maria, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The uncertainty about China's stock markets has led many people to believe its economy is fragile and about to break. Not so, say experts living and working inside China. Jeff Towson is the author of 1 Minute China and joins us from Beijing to describe how the continued push toward urbanization is changing domestic buying patterns. That's creating massive specialized urban areas and an economy that is looking more like in the West.
If everyone's on the countryside, you can't have factories. I mean, you can't have business services. You can't have tech coming. And so that is kind of the starting point. But it turns out, you know, it's really interesting. People are, you know, we're social creatures. You put us together and we change each other. So as soon as you put consumers in an urban environment in China, their buying patterns change. They start to buy like Europeans and Americans, you know, coffee and brands. And it appears to shift fundamentally once they go urban. You also see the GDP per capita start to increase rapidly.
When you have people clustered together like that, you have more people who are able to buy goods and services trading. You have people going to school, all the money. It really feeds into these other trends.
Now, I think that's a China phenomenon more, because if you look at cities in, say, Latin America, you don't necessarily see that. You see a lot of congestion, a lot of people living in dense cities. You don't necessarily see this rising GDP per capita. In China, if you look, you know, hundreds of cities you can look across, you see that. I mean, urbanization is part of that equation, but there's a lot more going on there. So, you know, a lot of interesting stuff happens when you get people into cities. You start to see specialization. Certain cities are all technology people. Certain cities are manufacturing expertise now. Shanghai's a finance city. You know, you're starting to see like the Hollywood of China, the Silicon Valley of China. So as they urbanize, you know, it's not all just generic cities. You see lots of sort of unique characteristics. Some cities we know that, you know, people spend twice as much on food and dining as another city, you know, 100 miles away. There's funny demographics.
And as you mentioned, it's more a country of clusters as opposed to just one big place.
Yeah, this was really, I think, a big insight. when you keep adding people to a city, it's not just going to get bigger. You know, it's not like you're going to have some megapolis like out of Blade Runner or something. There's different ways you can go. You can have lots of little cities. You can have one mega city. And what China appears to be developing as is basically a series of 20 to 30 clusters where you have these regions with one major city like Shanghai. And then you have maybe 20, 30, 50 smaller cities all linked into it. And the Chinese government has been pretty open about this, that they see, you know, 70, 80% of the Chinese GDP is going to be within these 20 clusters. And each one will be about the same as a European country. So, I mean, that's really how China looks today. Now, you know, maybe in the future you'll see more of sort of a more integrated continental economy like the United States. But right now it's almost like islands in this massive geography. It's a fun way to think about it. I think it gets you closer to the truth.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
British rock music legend David Bowie has died. On Friday, the iconic musician turned 69 and released Black Star, his 25th album. His Facebook and Twitter accounts say he died peacefully Sunday, surrounded by his family after a courageous 18-month battle with cancer. Owen Devereaux is a professor at Limerick University in Ireland, and he is one of three editors who put together the book David Bowie, Critical Perspectives. He spoke with VOA's Francis Alonso.
The amount of influences that Bowie drew upon, I mean, we were really struck when we were doing the book about the array of influences on Bowie, how well-read he was, his interest in cinema, in mime, in acting, in reading, you know, so many influences, poetry, different musical movements and so on. And his ability then to bring those together and draw upon them almost like a magpie in a nice way and use them in his art, in his music. I think what's also striking was obviously his ability to reinvent himself and to, I suppose, to the end, to be true to his art and not to worry too much about commercial success, even though that was important, but he was always experimenting, always willing to change.
He just released a new album. What can you tell me about that?
The album was released on his 69th birthday. The album is called Black Star. And even over the weekend, I was looking closely at the lyrics and indeed the video content associated with the album. And it's a very interesting record in the sense that it fuses lots of jazz and electronica and hip-hop. But what's striking, really, really striking about the record is the songs are largely about a man who is coming to terms with his own mortality, particularly the song Lazarus. The video for that is very complicated, very complex, but it's very, very telling. Here is a man, you know, thinking about what's going to happen when he dies, looking back on his life and so on. And indeed, that connects with the album that he released on his birthday in 2013. And again, he was reflecting on his previous work as an artist and coming to terms with growing old and the prospect of dying.
Speaking of dying, his death just caught the whole world by surprise from cancer. Is that typical of him to be private, even though he was a very public person?
Well, he's a very public person, but remember, David Bowie, as we understand David Bowie, is a construct. David Jones, the person, is very, very, very different. And I think it's quite striking in an age of social media, of Twitter, of Facebook and so on, when he was re-emerging in 2013, he was recording an album for 2 years in New York City, and nobody knew about that. There were no leaks, there were no rumors, Nobody knew anything about it. And just on his birthday, he announced, "Today I'm releasing some new music." So he was very much in control of what he was doing. And I suppose essentially, from what I understand, essentially a private person.
Now, where do you think his influence will be felt most?
I think it will be in combination, to be quite honest. I mean, he's obviously influential in terms of bands and in terms of how even how images are constructed around bands and people reinventing themselves like Lady Gaga and others. People are reinventing their image. From the vantage point of 2016 and, you know, given, you know, changes in values and so on, I think sometimes it's interesting that we tend to forget how shocking he was in the early 70s. I mean, he really challenged assumptions that we might have about gender, about sexuality, and so on. So I think that's, again, you know, something very, very strong in the art he created. He was a truly wonderful performer, and I'm glad as a human being to have experienced his music over the years. And, you know, I'm very sad about his passing, but his contribution has just been so immense.
Critical Perspectives. For Tracy Carter, our director, our engineer, Zeinab Abdel-Rahman, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. This is International Edition. We leave you with some of the final musical words from David Bowie.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Around the world, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Vietnam, Syria, Russia, Iran, and other countries, journalists are under siege and freedom of expression is under threat. The Committee to Protect Journalists reports that in 2014, more than 60 journalists were killed, hundreds imprisoned, and dozens remain missing. Reporters Without Borders notes that governmental attempts to silence journalists include censorship, harassment, restrictive NGO laws, and public threats by political leaders. Speaking at Columbia University in New York, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs Richard Stengel, himself a former journalist, described freedom of expression as a foundational human right. Challenges to that freedom, he said, are now deeper and more profound than at any time in decades. He described three: the physical dangers journalists confront in conflict zones and elsewhere, the shrinking space for free expression in countries with autocratic leadership, and the rise of disinformation. In the past, journalists trying to expose the truth were given a kind of safe pass, said Undersecretary Stengel. Now they are targets of regimes and of terrorists like ISIL. As such, supporting freedom of the press is a critical element of U.S. foreign policy. It is one of the issues that our diplomats around the world regularly address in bilateral talks with governments. One initiative provides trainings to journalists on physical and digital security and psychosocial care throughout the world. And the U.S. has invested over $100 million in internet freedom programs to provide tools and trainings to thousands of vulnerable civil society and independent journalists around the world. Finally, in response to the rise of disinformation from terrorist groups or autocratic regimes, the U.S. is being proactive, said Undersecretary Stengel, in claiming the space for truth-telling by pushing back on propaganda and falsehood with fact-based messages, as well as by supporting independent media around the world with financial, technical, and logistical support. And why? Because, as President Barack Obama has said, journalists give all of us as citizens the chance to know the truth about our countries, ourselves, our governments. That makes us better. It makes us stronger.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.